Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Empowering Family Caregivers on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Susan Bida, your host and co-founder of eCareDiary.com, a full-service website devoted to caregivers of the elderly. Thank you for tuning in to an exciting half hour on brain health. Before I introduce our distinguished guest, I'd like to remind everyone that you can listen to any of our past radio shows on www.ecarediary.com under blogs and under the Blog Talk Radio tab. We've had an incredibly diverse range of medical, healthcare, and elder care experts covering topics from caregiver stress to healthcare reform to end-of-life decision-making. I'm very delighted and honored to introduce today's guest, Dr. Paul Nussbaum. He is a licensed clinical neuropsychologist. He earned his doctorate in clinical psychology from the University of Arizona. Today, he is an adjunct professor in neurological surgery at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. I first met Dr. Nussbaum in New York City at an American Society on Aging lecture that he gave last summer and was fascinated by his advocacy of brain health, considering the high rates of dementia with, of course, longer life expectancy. Dr. Nussbaum has 25 years of experience in the care of older persons suffering from dementia and related disorders. He is the author of a new book called Saving Your Brain, released by McGraw-Hill. And having read it over the weekend, I was so surprised by how easy it was to read and how deeply personal a topic it is. I was expecting to read something very clinical and academic, and quite to the contrary, Dr. Nussbaum gives a very tangible explanation of how the brain works and what we must do to care for it. Dr. Nussbaum, it is an honor to have you on our show today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Susan. Pleasure's all mine. It's great to be here.
So, Dr. Nussbaum, before we discuss your mission and your work, can you please tell us what inspired you to study neuropsychology and the brain, and ultimately what led you to become a brain health ambassador?
Yeah, I've always been interested in human behavior, and that kind of led me to the path of clinical psychology. And while I was at the University of Arizona, studying what I thought was going to be a career in kind of traditional clinical psychology, I met a nationally known neuropsychologist, Al Kazniak, who was my mentor, who kind of took me under his wing and taught me about the brain, and really been so fascinated, particularly with how little I know about the brain, and that's kind of what drives me to continue to study it, and particularly in its relationship to human behavior. The issue with my detour towards brain health rather than being a traditional kind of doctor in our country, which, you know, a doctor in our country is a person who tends to treat disease better than anyone in the world, but we don't know a lot about health. I made a conscious effort to think and write and study health promotion, and in this case, health promotion for the brain.
Well, that's wonderful. And did you have personal experiences that led you to this field as well?
My brother is, I've got an older brother who's mentally retarded. He has a mental age of about 3, so they tell us, but he's doing just beautifully, and that taught me early on growing up in the house that about the brain, far earlier than when I got my nose into a textbook about, you know, what happens with a brain that may be disrupted a bit. But also on the other side of that is it taught me, in the case of my brother, how really brilliant the brain is and its ability to overcome those challenges. You know, and then early on I began working with frail elderly and with elderly who have disorders of the brain, and again learned the same lesson. Although there's a lot of challenges with things like Alzheimer's disease and deficits, it became abundantly clear that in those cases that these folks even have some brilliance left over. It's just a matter of tapping into where those brilliant areas remain in the brain.
Yes, and you actually share some incredible stories, and I think before we get to those stories, I'd really like to hear about your research work with Alzheimer's patients. I believe when you were working as a director for one of the senior care provider services, correct, or one of the senior care homes?
Yeah, we did a lot of what's called applied research, Susan, where we weren't necessarily, doing work in a laboratory. We were trying to take care of people out on the front line, and
right.
We did a lot of things such as build appropriate environments outside that these folks could interact with and engage in, and we measured things such as reduction in behavioral problems, increase in sleep, even increase in the number of hours caregivers would visit, because sometimes it's difficult for caregivers to visit these places because they tend not to be very easy to visit, but with these proper environments, we found that the number of hours caregivers would increase, and so that was all, very, very promising. So it was much more on the applied side in trying to improve quality of life for folks with Alzheimer's disease.
Are there some key things that you discovered in your work?
Yeah, Alzheimer's, in particular with Alzheimer's disease, a lot of your caregivers already know this, but it's a disease that can last a long time, over 10 years. And that there are different needs for each of these individuals as they progress through the disease. Early on, really one of the goals for us as care providers is try to help folks maintain their cognitive ability. We don't have a cure. We don't have prevention even per se. And as the disease advances, then it really turns much less into a maintenance issue and more so into an issue of promotion of quality of life. And comfort, particularly in the latter stages, and really building programs and having a proper approaches to the care of these folks can be achieved if you understand where the person is in that continuum of Alzheimer's. So that was always fascinating. It also was always fascinating for me to see how folks with Alzheimer's disease, even though, they may not be able to communicate in typical ways, I was always very, very careful to appreciate the fact that I felt like these folks with Alzheimer's were familiar with some of the folks in their surroundings, particularly their family members. Now, they may not be able to say that's my wife or my husband or my son or daughter, but you could see them change behaviorally in a good way oftentimes when familiar people would arrive. And I always thought psychologically that was very, very helpful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a relative who has Alzheimer's, absolutely. I mean, we see him every Christmas, and while he might not remember our names or recognize us, there's certainly a comfort level. And I'd like to actually hone in on the word comfort that you used earlier when dealing with Alzheimer's patients. And actually, I'm really intrigued by one of the stories in your book. There was a woman, I think, that you were working with who would cry during, meal times. Can you share with our audience a little bit about that story? Because I found this point particularly fascinating.
Yeah, that's a true story. When I first started out in my work, I was actually, I'm 47 now, Susan, for your listeners, and this was when I was 20, so that's 27 mm-hmm. years ago. And I was asked to do some research on a specialized unit for Alzheimer's residents here in Western Pennsylvania. And it's true, during the dinner hour, there was a woman there who sort of consistently would sit off to the side and cry. Now, this was a woman otherwise who was fairly pleasant throughout the day. And, I was new at this, so that can be a bit intimidating, but at some point I got up enough confidence to go over, sit down, and take her by her hand and ask her what she was upset about. And she told me that she was upset because she wasn't able to cook for her family, that, she felt like she wasn't doing accomplishing her role, which traditionally had been to cook the meals for her family. Now, as I studied that, it seemed to me two things. One, she had a memory, which was actually accurate. That was an accurate memory. The problem was it was out of context because certainly her kids were grown up. They didn't need to have meals cooked for them. And so what I tried to do with her to provide her comfort was to get her engaged in the preparation of the meal that was ongoing there on her unit. And that seemed to help quite a bit. That taught me, again, not from a textbook, but that clinically, the interaction in providing comfort, not in trying to change her memory, but trying to align her memory with behavior so that her memory was that she was a cook to provide for others, and so we tried to get her involved in cooking and providing for others. And that seemed to calm her down and give her, again, what I mentioned earlier was quality of life for her.
Right. And that's what it's about, I think, at that stage. Now, in your book, let's shift gears a little bit. The book is called Save Your Brain, and you strongly advocate a brain health lifestyle. Now, we hear about diet and exercise for the health of our bodies, and we hear about meditation or prayer for the health of our spirit. I think rarely do we hear about the health of our brains. Is this an emerging area of health, and why do you feel it's so important?
Yeah, it isn't that something, you know, the single greatest, most magnificent miracle ever designed, the human brain. You're right, Susan. It really has just made its way under the radar screen, at least as we think about it in the general
Amazing.
Public. And so that's good news. It's a bit interesting and humorous, but it's good news, too. We certainly need to one, be educated on the basics of our brain, which I try to accomplish in my book. And again, my work is not rocket science, as I like to tell people. I'm trying to communicate with mothers and fathers and children across the dinner table out there in the world. And so trying to get everybody to learn about this wonderful part of who they are, because it really is who they are. And then teaching the brain in a very personal way. So it's not an academic or clinical thing. You know, it's a very personal story. I did this morning with some financial planners here in Western PA. And from there, then, we can talk about what we know about the human brain, and there's some really great things we now know, Susan, for example, that the human brain, your listeners out there might be interested to know that their brain can actually generate new brain cells, that it can be shaped across their entire life, that age really doesn't matter, and that there are things that we can do from a lifestyle perspective that apply to the brain. Like you said, the same way that we already know that it may apply for our muscles or for our heart, we can now think and behave in a way that, you know, says, hey, we want to promote the health of our brain. And as I like to say, always try to maintain access to our life story, because that's what your brain has. It has your life story that needs to be shared with the next great generation of little ones.
No, and this is so important because, obviously, dementia, the rate of dementia has been increasing since many of us are living longer into our 80s, 90s, and even hundreds. So
Right. What
you're actually saying here is that we can actually do things that can prevent diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's. Is that what you're saying?
I would not use the word prevent, but I would say that we do not have a cure. I don't use the word prevention, but there are things we can do to build up what's called brain reserve. And let me take a second just to explain that to folks, because that sounds like a fancy thing, but it really just describes the fact that when you expose your brain to enriched and complicated environments, your brain reacts, and it reacts by building up a part of the brain cell we call dendrites. And when I describe this to people, I try to get them to visualize an image, which is if you're flying at 500 feet looking down over a jungle, and you look down and you see the trees and they're so dense, you can't see the land. That's very different than flying over, let's say, an island where you only see one palm tree. And if you think about Alzheimer's disease, and I'm not trying to be funny here right now, if you think about Alzheimer's disease as a weed whacker, it comes in and obliterates weeds, or not weeds, but brain cells. And if you think about it from a health perspective, we all want our brains to look like that jungle that I described. And the reason is because having that many cellular connections will help to push off or delay the onset of things like Alzheimer's. Again, no cure, but indeed, there are cases out there established where you can delay the onset of these diseases, even to the point of death, where a person lives a very high quality of life with independence, even though the disease is there. And what we're learning is how we live our lives and what we choose to do each and every day does have a consequence in terms of the integrity structurally and behaviorally and functionally of our brain. So this is a proactive story for everyone out there. It's never too early. It's never too late. The way that I teach it is it begins in the womb, and it goes until our last breath on this planet Earth. And, lifestyle is critical. It's not necessarily, you know, the final word, but it is an important word that needs to be paid attention to.
Absolutely. Let's turn a second back to Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, my grandfather is 92 years old. He has been diagnosed with dementia. He's not diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Can you explain to us what are dementia and Alzheimer's? I think there's a bit of confusion out there about these terms, particularly amongst lay people, since they're often used interchangeably.
Yeah, you're right, Susan, and my field can probably take some blame for that, because I think there's probably more confusion than we'd be comfortable with even in my own field, in the healthcare field. It's a great question. Dementia is, everyone can, just as a general term, it describes a loss of intelligence, memory problems, other cognitive deficits such as language or visual-spatial deficits. It describes personality change and functional impairment. In other words, a person can't do some of the things they're used to doing, dressing, bathing, writing checks, driving, these kinds of things.
Right.
There are 100 different types of dementia, okay? So once we establish whether or not there's a dementia, like I just defined it, we can then ask the question, well, what's the cause? Alzheimer's disease, at least in this country, is the number one cause. It probably accounts for 50 to 70% of all cases of dementia.
Okay.
95% of all cases of dementia are irreversible. They will not get better. About 3 to 5% are reversible. Most of these cases of dementia occur later in life, though not all. So if we know nothing else and we know that somebody has a dementia and you had to make a guess and you weren't getting any more information, you'd probably guess it's Alzheimer's just simply because of the statistics. You were right, correctly speaking earlier when you said that, you know, dementia seems to be on the rise, and that's true mainly because we are living longer, but there's some other things going on out there I think that we don't quite understand yet. But that's the difference between dementia, again, which is a general term, and Alzheimer's, which is a specific cause of dementia.
Okay. Now, I'd like to turn now to, I think, what I find very fascinating is your description of something as complex as the brain, and you make it very easy for lay people like myself to understand. I was not the best science student in school. So I really appreciate the work that you've done, and I really enjoyed your online course on paulnussbaum.com. It was very very easy and unintimidating to grasp. Can you tell us about the main parts of the brain and why you feel it's so important for us lay people to understand more about it?
Yeah, well, the reason it's so important to understand it is because it really helps you to learn more about yourself and why we're such funny people sometimes, and why we have different talents, and why our personality is the way it is, and how we can improve, you know, all of us, myself included. The brain weighs 2 to 4 pounds on average. It's made up of 60% fat. It's actually one of the fattest parts of you and one of the fattest parts of me and everyone else out there. Most people
I have
don't
to
know.
Say that is the biggest surprise. I didn't realize the brain
yeah.
was so fatty.
Yeah, and it's that fat that helps to insulate those brain cells and propel information. And then the other basic point is that every time the heart beats, 25% of the blood from that heartbeat goes right to the brain. So a lot of people don't know that one either. And those points really help to do two things. One is to educate you about the basics of the brain, and two, help to explain why different aspects of the lifestyle are health promoting. If your brain's made up of 60% fat, then we got to have the right fat getting into our bodies. If the heart beats and the brain takes 25% of the blood, we got to make sure that we're being physically active. So there's some real good understanding points here, teaching points for everyone to realize and appreciate with regard to the lifestyle. Now, the human brain has a very convoluted top part that most of us think of as the brain. That's called the cortex, C-O-R-T-E-X, which is the conscious information processing system. Cortex means the bark of a tree. It's the outer shell. And in the back of your brain is where you see. It's called the occipital lobe. Under each temple, everybody has two temples on each side of their head. That's called the temporal lobe. Very, very important for memory and new learning, for auditory processing, and for even appreciating spirituality, things like God, this type of thing. There's a whole field called neurotheology, Susan, that scientists are looking at in terms of the relationship between God and the brain. And they're looking at the temporal lobe. The parietal lobe sits just on top of the temporal lobe, which and kind of in the back, and it helps us get around in the world, know our left from right. It helps us with mathematics. It helps us with some memory. And in the front part of our brain really is, for me, the most brilliant part. It's the youngest member of the family. It evolved most recently. It's also the largest member of the four areas of the brain. And this is where you have an ability to organize your world and structure your world and carry out routines. And this is where your personality is. This is where you're able to plan into the future and inhibit certain behaviors. Interestingly, you know Alzheimer's disease is a little bit advanced because it starts in the back and moves forward. But you know it moves forward when the behaviors start to become problematic. You know, Dad is walking outside. It's 30 below, and he doesn't have the proper clothing on. Or Mom's getting in fights at the grocery store. It's not because they're bad people. It's because their frontal lobe has been damaged by the disease. It's what keeps us socially graceful.
Right. Well, you described the brain as a miraculous organ, which it is, and you also talk about brain plasticity. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, plasticity is an old term, actually, which has gained a lot of momentum as we're talking more about the brain. The way that I describe plasticity is just a brain that's highly dynamic, constantly reorganizing and malleable. It can be shaped across your lifespan. Some of us were taught probably erroneously so that there's a critical period of brain development, which insinuated that at about age 5 or 6, things stopped. And it's important for everyone to understand that those are critical periods of brain development in childhood, but so are the teen years, so are the 20s and 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way up, like you said, to folks over 100, again, because your brain doesn't know how old you are. So having plasticity means having some opportunity to shape your brain the way you want to shape it. And what we're talking about today, Susan, is shaping it towards health. And age doesn't matter about that.
And, you know, on this discussion about the brain being able to develop future reserves with our conscious working at it, I'm very fascinated by the landmark study that led to that discovery. Could you expound on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, that was in 1998, which really wasn't that long ago at all when you think about it in terms of how long we've been on the planet.
Right.
There were some folks actually studying throat cancer, and this was published by a group in San Diego and in Sweden. It was Erickson and colleagues in a journal called Nature. And they were studying throat cancer, and what they – somebody had the ingenuity to preserve some cells in what are called the hippocampus. That's a very important part of your brain, and your listeners can go onto my website, paulnussbaum.com, and see a picture if they want of the hippocampus. That's the structure that helps everybody learn new information. Okay, that's the thing that's so important to the education system and the library system and all of us who are interested in lifelong learning. But they preserved some cells, and lo and behold, they discovered in the lab that these, and this was in humans, that there was new cell development occurring in this part of the brain. And heretofore, prior to 1998, we had always figured that the human brain did not have the ability to generate new brain cells. We thought animals had that capacity way back in the 1950s, but for some funny reason, we didn't think humans could. So this was kind of the first study of its kind, and other studies have come forward. So it's really not a debate anymore. The human hippocampus, and it turns out the olfactory system, which is where we have the sense of smell, seems to be able to generate new brain cells. The debate now is, can other parts of the human brain generate new brain cells? And probably my guess is one day we're going to learn that it can. It's just too complicated. It's too brilliant not to be able to do that.
Right. And I think the big lesson here is that what we really need to do is constantly stimulate our brain with what you call novel and complex experiences. What does this actually mean for brain health? So can you I think elaborate on that?
Yeah, what your listeners have to think about is brain health occurs in the cortex, that outer convoluted shell that you and I were talking about earlier, where you consciously process information. Just underneath that cortex, you have a number of older, more primitive structures we refer to as the subcortex, you know, under the cortex. And that's where subconscious processing tends to take place. Brain health really doesn't take place there. Now, here's the difference. In the cortex, when you engage in activities or behaviors that are what I call novel and complex or new and hard, you're going to stimulate that cortex, and that's where you're going to build brain reserve. When you engage in behaviors that are routine or passive, and we all do this, you're not going to stimulate the cortex. Those are the behaviors you can do where you're really not thinking about doing them. Believe it or not, when you get dressed or when you're driving, particularly in a familiar environment, we tend not to be that conscious of what we're doing, believe it or not. When we sit and type or play instruments, if we're very good at it, it tends to be that if you're engaging in a talent all the time, you're really not using your cortex a whole lot because you've already master that skill. So when you do things that you're not very good at, those are going to be the challenging ones where you're going to build up brain reserve.
So we have to do things out of our comfort zone, so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah, and even the word comfort, Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. Because when you think about it, as you practice, you're going to be more comfortable, and you're going to be develop a talent there. And that's kind of the decision point, not to give that up. Nobody's saying you have to give it up, but go on to something else where you're not so comfortable. And that really is what lifelong learning is about.
Yeah, and I think that's a great message, too, that, you know, learning never stops, and reinventing yourself never stops at any given age. It really should be carried on well into your 80s and 90s even.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah. Don't even think about age.
Right. So let's talk about, I guess, the five critical aspects of brain health lifestyle. And I really love how you talk about brain health lifestyle, because we don't think about it as a lifestyle.
Right. And this is all meant to be proactive, because I think a lot of these diseases are also proactive. So we have to combat that with our own proactive health approach. And there's really five slices of the brain health pie, as I like to call it. One is, and these are in no special order, but socialization, physical activity, mental stimulation, nutrition, and spirituality. And so those five really make a gestalt. And what we have to do is look at each of the behaviors within those slices of the pie that research tells us promotes brain health, and try to get busy in areas where we may be weak, because all of us have weak areas, including me. All of us have strong areas. But think about this as a gestalt, that means as a whole, not as fragmented pieces. Because your brain works as a whole. It doesn't work as a subset of systems.
Right. Now, you did a recent pilot study, I think, back in as recently as 2008. Can you share some of the findings from that pilot study?
Yeah, this was with Emeritus Assisted Living, which I believe is the largest assisted living organization in the country, and I serve as the National Director of Brain Health for them. And we wanted to look at whether the different behaviors within each of those slices of the pie, for example, physical activity, engaging in some aerobic exercise or walking or dance with socialization, have a recreational opportunities to work with groups of people, on and on and on. Nutrition, eating more salmon that has the good fats we talked about. Did that have any impact on things such as mood or cognition, like memory or quality of life? And what we found after 6 weeks was that about 12 independent living older adults did better on memory tests at the end of the 6 week program, which they engaged in this lifestyle on a daily basis relative to controls. We also found their quality of life to improve. And so in my opinion, although the numbers were quite small, only 12, you can't make, you know, grandiose statements about this, it was an indication that indeed this kind of lifestyle does seem to help with cognition and quality of life. The goal now is to find similar results in more sophisticated studies with larger sample size. But that was all good news, and to date, this was done up in Massachusetts. They continue to have this brain health program ongoing there at that campus.
Oh, terrific. And we can learn more about, I think, these aspects in your book as well as on your website, paulnussbaum.com. Just honing in on socialization for a moment, I quote you, I believe you actually say that you discourage retirement. Do you not in your book?
I do.
I laughed when I read this. I'm like,
sometimes people get mad at me for that one.
And I think it's very good that you, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you know, the trick is that for more people out there than some may be comfortable with, retirement sometimes involves withdrawing and isolating and segregating. And that's the last thing we want if we're interested in brain health, because remember, if the body isolates and segregates, the brain does too. And passivity is a bad thing for the brain. So you can retire from a job, but we don't want people to retire from life. And indeed, the good news is baby boomers, like you just said, are going to reinvent themselves several times across their lifespans, a little bit different than, you know, our parents when they retired. So I really strongly encourage people to stay incredibly involved. If that means employment, that's great. If it means volunteering, that's great. But it's got to be something that, you know, you're passionate about, where you're contributing, where it's meaningful for you on a daily basis, and get you out of the bed each and every day.
Wonderful. I keep referring to your online video class. I really enjoyed watching it. I felt like I was back in school. And in that class, you talk about the fact that the brain has so much untapped potential. Could you share with the audience what your thoughts are about the future? I think some of the things that you believe the brain can potentially do someday.
Yeah, I refer to this as neural energies, and it really just represents, you know, my primitive understanding of the brain is really an energy source. It's electrical, it's chemical, and it's probably spiritual. There's probably energy there we don't understand yet. But I just believe, and I'm speculating now for everyone out there, that the human brain one day will be able to fix the maladies of the body. I do believe brains will communicate with other brains almost telepathically without opening the mouth. I know the military is already doing some research on these things. You know, when you look at, you know, with my audiences, I have fun and ask everybody who has seen Rain Man, you know, and almost everybody has seen the movie Rain Man. And, you know, everybody knows that Rain Man was at the blackjack table and winning all this money because he could calculate the cards and the numbers faster than most computers. And he made a lot of money. And my question to everybody is, well, who's really, you know, abnormal here? Is it Rain Man or the rest of us? And, you know, it harkens me back to what my mentor taught me, which is that, you know, if one brain can do that thing that we would call brilliant or a miracle, then it can be done, right? And maybe it's just the rest of us need to learn how to tap into the brilliance that is the brain. And we're not there yet. We're still too primitive. I think once we tap into the energies and the brilliance of the brain, we're going to radically shift civilization as we know it. And that's all good stuff. You know, I sit back and listen to all the new inventions, the iPod, the iPad, all these things, which are great. The new cell phones, the computers, they're going faster than, you know, anything. But, you know, everybody needs to understand what created those gadgets. It's the human brain. And we need to turn our energies inward, at least some part of the time, to try to figure out what's going on inside of us. The cure for Alzheimer's and the cure for cancer and world peace and all those things are within the folds and flaps of our cortex. That's where the answers are.
Well, that's very exciting, Dr. Nussbaum, and it's a very hopeful message to end on, and I wish we had more time to pick your brain, as it were, on this show. However, we've reached the end, and I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. The audience can learn more about Dr. Nussbaum's online brain health classes on his website, www.paulnussbaum.com. His book, Save Your Brain, is available on Amazon.com, and it's also available in the shopping section of the eCareDiary.com website. Thank you again, Dr. Nussbaum. I hope you'll come back again in the near future and maybe share some of your new findings, I'm sure, as you continue your work in this field of study. I'd like to thank our audience for tuning in, and join us next time on Monday, September 20th at 2 p.m. Eastern, when Barbara Friesner, generational coach and founder of AgeWise Living, will be with us to discuss the issues affecting the elderly and their families. To learn more about eCare Diary's free online calendar and management tools, visit www.ecarediary.com. Registration is free and gives you immediate access to the Care Diary tool and social media benefits. We are also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. My Twitter address is eCareDiarySusan. And Dr. Nussbaum, do you have a Twitter address or a Facebook page?
I do. They can all be found right on my website. All those social networking tools can be found on my website as well, Susan. Thank you.
Terrific. Well, thank you again, and we'll tune in next time. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.